the debate.
Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Kobe Tahwayi. In the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied Palestine, some 28 Palestinian families are facing the threat of forceful evictions from the neighborhood. Palestinian homes and structures in the area are being demolished for the construction of a new Israeli settlement outpost. That is part of a regular occurrence that happens in the occupied territories. Now, in this edition of The Debate, we will look at why Israel can go ahead and break international law this way, while it also continues its efforts to Judaize Jerusalem outwards. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Debate. We have Mick Knapp here from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. And we also have Saad Nim, who's a professor of political science at Birzeit University, who joins us. I'd like to welcome you both. If I may, to start with you, Mick Knapp here. As I mentioned just now, the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood is an example in occupied Palestine. You're having 20 Palestinian families facing this threat of evictions, and they're going to be replaced, or that area be placed with new settlements. First of all, isn't this against international law?
Well, yes. It's against international on many, many different levels. Look, this has been going on for so many years. Before I was barred from going to Palestine by the Israelis, I visited Sheikh Jarrah, and there was a resistance tent erected there because people were, many, many years ago, threatened with you know, being dispossessed. And what struck me, and it's one of the things that you never forget, is that the little children went to school in those days and they took their precious toys with them because they were afraid when they came home their house might be demolished or they might be locked out of it. And it's that situation of living in fear which is the lot of Palestinians in this part of Jerusalem. And it's not just some local, petty Hitler. This is government policy. And at the top echelons of the government, there's no doubt about it. There's open, in which other country in the world would you find open discussion, not just in low-life bars, but in university departments, that there are too many Jews in this area and we have to get rid of them, or there are too many black people? We have a problem with racism in Britain, but we don't have open discussion and university seminars on how to get rid of a certain ethnic group. That's the reality of Israel. The plan to Judaize Jerusalem, to make life hellish for Palestinians and drive out as many as possible, is not a secret. It's absolutely known to all concerned, and this latest ratcheting up of pressure on 28 families is because they are Palestinians. If they were Jews from America or anywhere in the world, it's inconceivable that this could happen to them in Israel. This is apartheid on steroids. This is, of course, a version of apartheid which made, I think it was Desmond Tutu, who knew a thing about these things, to say, compared to what the Palestinians were going through in South Africa, hellish as it was, he said it was a picnic.
Well, Saad Nim, what is interesting is, according to the ICC, and this is something that's not maybe very well known, the forcible transfer of population and associated war crimes and crimes against humanity actually fall within the Rome Statute. Can you break that open for us as to the depth of what Israel is doing, how the ICC sees it as possible war crimes?
Look, let's put things in perspective. It is a war crime. It is ethnic cleansing. And we should name it in the exact name of ethnic cleansing. And ethnic cleansing is a war crime, not only as described by the United Nations, by all encyclopedias, as well as the ICC. Now, what the ICC could do about it, I think that the Palestinian now had put forward the issue of Sheikh Jarrah in front of the ICC also, in addition to the other cases in front of the ICC. But from our perspective and the world perspective, I would agree with Mick in Edinburgh, who said that it's not silent and it's not invisible. It's visible to everyone around the world, and no one is doing anything. This is the hypocrisy which is going on. If any case of ethnic cleansing had happened in anywhere, as it happened in Rwanda or in Bosnia, the whole world was involved, and they wanted to end this issue in a way or another, because this is a war crime. But once it comes to Israel, no one is doing anything about it. 28 homes are going to be demolished, and the people will be evacuated. We are talking about almost nearly 500 people are going to be evacuated from Sheikh Jarrah, under the pretension that before 1948, this area was Jewish families living there, and they claim the land and they claim the property. What about the Palestinian property in West Jerusalem? What about all the properties that we lost everywhere in Israel now? No one is talking about that. But when it comes to the Palestinians, yes, the Israeli court is absolutely, as a part of the occupation system, is ruling against the Palestinians in order to get them out of Sheikh Jarrah. Not only this issue, but in June, we are coming also for another court for another area called Kubaniyat Imharoon, which is another neighborhood in Sheikh Jarrah, also under the same situation. And it will be going to be evicted and evacuation of the Palestinians there, and they will claim the land to build a new settlement there. We have to mention also that in Sheikh Jarrah, within these 28 houses, already four families were evicted, and no one did anything about it. Now we are leaving that to Jerusalem people, to the Jerusalemites, to the young men of Jerusalem who are fighting face to face with the Israeli, with their naked chests, with nothing in their hands but their faith in their rights in Jerusalem, to defend the neighborhood of Jerusalem. We have to do something about it. Tomorrow is the final day, Thursday, and tomorrow will be the final ruling of the court, and it should take the ruling against the Palestinians as usual, because again, the courts in Israel are absolutely part of the occupation when it comes to the Palestinians. So what we are looking now is not only the ICC. We are appealing to the whole international community, who are always talking about democracy and about human rights, and they are giving us all these ethical lessons. Please now do some of your ethical lessons to what's going on in Jerusalem, and stop the hypocrisy that is going on when it comes to Israel.
Okay. Mick Napier, you know, you in your previous statements there talked about government policy, and you also threw in the word Judaism in there. I'd like to ask you whether there is an actual concrete plan that has been enshrined perhaps in the pages somewhere of Israeli cabinets, where they follow a blueprint, and it has many different ways of what amounts to changing the demographics of the occupied territories to their liking. And Jerusalem al-Quds perhaps is one of the many areas where they do this, and through different methods. Can you tell us what those methods are? And if you agree with the way I worded this in my outlook here.
No, it's a very good question, because the Israeli upper echelons are often very careful about committing to paper obvious criminality. The desire, the commitment to ridding Palestine of its Palestinians and replacing them with Jewish Zionists from around the world, it is as old as Theodor Herzl. And that's never been challenged since then by the leading bodies in Zionism. And the record shows that before 1948, but since 1948, not a week has gone by, but some property in Palestine has changed hands. Sometimes vast amounts of property, sometimes only a few dunams. But the trend is invariably week after month after year that the property moves from being Palestinian property. But, sorry, I correct myself. It remains Palestinian property, but it is seized by the Israeli state and put into a category that it can only be for Jews, that Palestinians may not live on it, may not lease, certainly may not buy it. And this trend has only ever gone one way. High court judges in Israel have pontificated on their benches while living in Palestinian homes, and they have ruled that those homes which have been seized from Palestinians can never be returned to them, but can only be sold to Jews. If you imagine a situation where the mafia controls a state, but then passes laws to justify the theft and pillage and plunder, that's the situation in Israel today. How many of your viewers know that about 94% of Palestine today is out of bounds for purchase or leasing by Palestinians, even Palestinian citizens of Israel? Even those who were trapped inside Israel in 48 and had to become citizens, they are denied access to this, to vast areas of land inside the apartheid state. The situation is one of extreme lawlessness. I mean, of course it's apartheid. Of course it's two sets of laws for Palestinians, one for Jews, one for Palestinians. Of course there are some Jewish-only roads which Palestinians may not travel on. But it's even worse than that. This is a situation where, I've actually visited a place in East Jerusalem where the Palestinian family was living in their own garden, and there were settlers whom I saw. I was a few feet from them. They were sneering and jeering at the Palestinian family. I think they had American accents. And they were living in the home which had been taken over by the state and ordered to be given to them. It is beyond the language of anyone except a poet to convey the horror of what's happening in Palestine. The naked racism, which makes no attempt to hide itself. And I would add just a Russian proverb, a fish rots from the head. If you look at what's going on at the top of the Israeli government, the openly genocidal language, people like Otto Veli and so on, who's their new ambassador in Britain, she openly calls for the expulsion of every last Palestinian, Muslim and Christian, citizen of Israel or not. And it's in front of our faces. And our other guest is absolutely right.
Well, let me ask you that now. Today, let me jump in since we're quickly running out of time. Sorry about that, McNabb here. Sadnim, today we had a number of scholars, religious leaders, and high-ranking officials who talked about the last Friday of the month of Ramadan in terms of what that signifies. And I want to ask you what that day is. Why is it so important? Because you talked about how the world needs to get off on its feet in terms of the international community, I should say the so-called international community, to make sure that these types of things don't happen to Palestine. Tell us what this Friday, a couple days from now, what the name is, what it means, and why is it so important that the world has actually embraced that day and keeps that alive, so to speak, not only just for that day, but also throughout the year.
Yes, thank you for that. And we are approaching now the last Friday in Ramadan. And as usual, since late Al-Khomeini make that day as a day of Jerusalem, it became very important. And it's also important for us because now Muslims all around the world, we are talking about millions of Muslims, not only in Iran, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Syria, and other countries in the region, but also in Europe and wherever there are Muslims, are doing, sorry, they are remembering this day and celebrating this day, the last last Friday of Ramadan, to celebrate Jerusalem and to bring up the idea of Jerusalem. It's well known fact that Jerusalem is not only for the Palestinians. Palestinians definitely are the one who are defending Jerusalem now and face to face with the occupation and with the everyday atrocities by the Israeli Zionist government. But at the same time, Jerusalem is important to all Muslims around the world, as well as also to Christians. Remember that the holy sites are for the Muslims and the Christians equally in Jerusalem. So marking the day of Jerusalem around the world, and especially in Iran, definitely that is giving us a kind of support, even if it's a moral support for the Palestinians. But we believe that the day will be closer and closer when we really celebrate together in Jerusalem after it is liberated from this colonialist project called Israel in general. The Jerusalem Day, over all the years, it became very controversial for all those who are against either Iran or the bloc, which is the resistance bloc, if you like, in the Arab world, and also against the Palestinians. They don't like it, they don't want to see it, because it reminds them how they are not doing nothing, especially when we are talking about states in the Gulf, that they do nothing to Jerusalem in reality, but at the same time, they are embarrassed of this day when everyone goes into these millions of people going into the streets to celebrate this day for Jerusalem, and to say that Jerusalem is an Arab Islamic city and it should be come back again under the control of the Palestinian people and for the Arab and the Muslims, and to get rid of this occupation and to get rid of this colonial project, which was created in 1948 by European decisions at that time, regardless of how racist and how it become today. From racist at that time till today, it became an apartheid regime totally, since now the numbers are talking about the over the majority of people who are living in historical Palestine are Palestinian, are over the Jewish population. So it is an apartheid regime. It's a racist regime by definition. When Herzl said to create a Jewish state only for Jews, it means that it is by definition Zionist is a racist movement. And if you create a state based on racism, so definitely we are talking about the results will be not only racism and also an apartheid regime.
Okay, since you're talking about apartheid regime there, I'd like to bring you in, McNabb, here for what has happened recently and see whether this is going to get anywhere. And that was something that Human Rights Watch actually gave out, in which it said discrimination against Palestinians by Israeli laws and policies amount to the crimes of apartheid. That it was a very long report accusing Israel of operating a system of apartheid in occupied Palestinian territories, concluded that in certain areas they amount to the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. Good thing that Human Rights has watched that, has made that report in the form and manner that it did. But basically, the big question is, how will that translate into action on the ground? I mean, do these types of reports that come out and highlight what Israel is doing, amounting to it being an apartheid regime, make a difference for the lives of Palestinians?
Is that addressed to myself?
Yes.
I don't think it makes a difference to the lives of Palestinians today. I don't think when you look at the fall of other racist systems or other brutal oppressions, they fall suddenly. Life often gets much worse before this nightmare can lift. I think what's key is that the decision by Human Rights Watch so late in the day to say that Israel has become an apartheid state, it's not perfect. Zionism was an apartheid system from its very inception. Before the state was set up, the Jewish colonies were run on an apartheid basis of trying to damage Palestinians as much as possible. But what has happened is, for many years, the Palestinian resistance, the heroism of these young men, and not just young men, the whole population in Jerusalem has inspired people around the world. And the decision by Human Rights Watch, and an impending decision by Amnesty as well, to reach the same belated conclusion, is a tribute to the heroism of the Palestinian people. their determination against insuperable odds to continue. And that's what's happened. They cannot defeat Israel by force of arms, not while there is an air bridge of weapons from Washington and America, sorry, and the EU to Israel. But they have won in a crucial area, and that's world public opinion. Israel is already a polecat state. It's a pariah state. Even those governments which are arming Israel, such as my own, well understand that popular opinion is very, very opposed to that. And the BDS movement, of course, exists to channel that public opinion, which is already there, into actively isolating and weakening the apartheid state. The Palestinians are the inspiration. They are winning, even though it's at tremendous cost.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. That's Mick Knapp here from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, from Edinburgh, also Saad Nirm. Thank you, Professor of Political Science at Merced University. We do appreciate your comments. And you don't forget, this Friday is Al-Quds Day rallies that are going to be held in recognition of the plight of Palestinians. We're going to be covering that, I'm sure, for a major portion of the day. It's the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. And, of course, we would like for you to tune in and see what's going on that day. From Mikhail Tafa, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye until the next debate.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Hello and welcome to our program. This is Month of Allah. And I'm with you with another episode in which we talk about the ahkam regarding the month of Ramadan, the necessary things and topics that we need to know about this holy month. Previously, I talked about illness and sickness and some of the matters surrounding it. What is the criteria in sickness? We said that sometimes you become sick and this is an excuse for you. You need to take medicines because you are sure that not taking medicines and not taking measures to cure yourself is going to make your health very much worse, or you are afraid that if you don't do so you're going to feel worse. Then we said that this is an excuse for you. And in other positions and conditions, when you are some illnesses might happen that are not substantial, so you can tolerate them, it's all right. This session I'm going to say that when you become sick and it is an acceptable excuse, it means that you have to compensate for it after the month of Ramadan when you feel well again. All right, but sometimes it happens that a person becomes sick and that sickness lasts up to the next year. So up to the next Ramadan, the sickness has not ended. So in this case, there are no qada necessary for that person. Means that person should not fast again because of the days that he has lost in the first Ramadan. The only thing that that person needs to do is to give 750 grams of food, as we talked about before in atonement, to the poor people. Each person... for each fast that we could not have, right? For example, that person has been sick for 5 days in the month of Ramadan, right? After the Ramadan, up to the next year, could not fast again because did not feel well again. So only next year that person has to feed five poor people. The next thing to say is that up to the noon, so from the morning up to the noon, in the first like half of the period of fasting, a person can break the fast, but not an obligatory fast which is in month of Ramadan, but after the month of Ramadan, the fast that we have because we need to make up for the fast that we couldn't have, right? The Sawm al-Qadha, as we talked about before. So if this is not the fast in month of Ramadan, this is another obligatory fast after the Ramadan. From the morning up to the noon, you have time to break your fast. For example, something has happened for you. You cannot fast. You need to go, for example, to a place, a very short travel, or you feel very sick. It's okay. You can break your fast. All right? And the other day, you can start again. But in month of Ramadan, you cannot do that. And if someone has an excuse, for example, is sick, or a woman, for example, the period starts in the middle of the month of Ramadan and cannot fast for those limited days. After month of Ramadan, if that person dies without having the chance to compensate for it, it's all right and there is nothing to compensate. So if you are sick, your sickness lasts up to the next year, you don't need to compensate, you just need to give food. And also if you don't find time to compensate, there is nothing on you. Thank you so very much and goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
It is estimated that prior to the pandemic, 27 million people worked in the EU's hospitality sector. Small to medium-sized firms are described as the backbone of the 27 nation bloc's finances. The Eurozone economy has contracted further and is now in a so-called double-dip recession. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts.
It's impossible to stop everything. You know, the corona is there, the economy is dead.
Like waitresses or waiters, and they lost their jobs, so they are in a bad condition now.
Me too. Like, I work, and my work is impact of the coronavirus.
It's very difficult to have hope, because we don't know how it's going on, and we don't know what the future it's made.
More and more workers lost their jobs, like restaurants.
Members of the European Parliament say the EU's aviation and tourism industries need emergency assistance.
Businesses in the hospitality sector are on their knees. They need not just financial support, but also longer-term measures to restart and recover. The tourism may never be the same.
Lawmakers say the EU's vaccination rollout is too slow. Just 10% of the population have been fully vaccinated. They are also highly critical over a lack of joined-up thinking when it comes to implementing COVID-19 restrictions. Governments were supposed to submit applications to the European Commission for recovery funding by last Friday. So far, just 14 of the 27 have done so. There is concern that the process lacks transparency.
We have encouraged all member states to make the submitted plans to the Commission public. But again, it's up to the member states to decide what they wish to publish.
An unprecedented social crisis might be on the horizon for the EU. It's possible the millions of jobs that have been lost so far only represent the tip of the iceberg. Several studies have concluded that up to one quarter of small to medium-sized businesses in the EU will go under once restrictions are lifted and government supports are taken away. These are firms that employ 250 people or less. Clearly, then, we're talking about huge numbers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey prioritizes Libya's integrity, sovereignty and independence. This is what Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu told his counterpart Najla Almankoş in a statement made after his visit, along with Defense Minister Hulusi Akar, Intelligence Chief Hakan Fidan and the Chief of Staff Yaşar Güler to Tripoli. During the meeting, Almankoş urged Turkey to help implement a UN Security Council resolution demanding the retrieval of foreign fighters from Libya. Cavusoglu responded to the remarks by saying that Turkish troops and mercenaries sent by Ankara were deployed in Libya as part of an agreement made with the previous administration and were only present for the purpose of training.
In the face of the attacks on Tripoli over the past years, the legitimate government of Libya invited some countries, including us. Only Turkey replied in the affirmative to this call. Turkey's support for Libya prevented a civil war and human tragedy.
This visit is seen by many as very important for Turkey to maintain good ties with the new Libyan government and make sure agreements are not broken due to political changes in Tripoli. However, it seems that the new government does not welcome foreign troops anymore.
Turkey signed an agreement with the central government in Tripoli, which is recognized by the UN. Based on that agreement, Turkey sent troops and mercenaries to Libya. Unless that agreement is broken by any or both sides, Turkish troops will continue to be present there. Turkish forces are not alone there. There are also Syrian fighters, Chadian army, as well as Russian. Their presence must also be questioned.
Turkey also signed an agreement with the previous Libyan government on maritime boundaries in the Mediterranean, which created tensions between Turkey and Greece. Ankara sees a great importance in maintaining good relationship with the Tripoli amid mounting tensions in eastern Mediterranean. Libya is still considered Turkey's strategic partner. For Turkey, the visit meant to make sure things are still going well after the new Libyan interim government was sworn in. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests, almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and their remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance, and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign ministry spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Yemeni army said it had launched an operation using 4 drones of Qassaf K2 type and 2 ballistic missiles of Badr type against Saudi Arabia target in King Khalid Air Base in Asir and other military targets in Najran Airport.
Our operation targeted Saudi airports because they are being used for warplanes to take off and launch airstrikes on the Yemeni people. They are also used to reinforce the Saudi-backed forces in Ma'rib and the rest of the battlefronts. We carry out the operation based on accurate information that reached us from the Saudi depths.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army said this attack came in response to the continued escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its tighter restrictions on fuel imports. He vowed larger attacks if the war is not yet stopped.
The continuation of the Yemenis' attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia confirms that the Yemeni army has developed its military capabilities to inflict further damage to Saudi sites. The Yemeni army aims to protect Yemen's airspace against Saudi airstrikes in conjunction with the continued advancement toward the city of Ma'rib.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015. The Saudi war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children and brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Experts say the Yemeni army's retaliatory attacks sent this clear message to Saudi Arabia and its allies that the more attacks against Yemeni civilians and tighter blockade, the more painful attacks against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden called North Korea a threat in his first address to Congress as his administration announced it had completed a long-awaited review of American policy toward Pyongyang. Biden's remarks were soon followed up by his Director of National Intelligence.
For its part, North Korea may take aggressive and potentially destabilizing actions to reshape its security environment and will seek to drive wedges between the United States and its allies. These efforts could include the resumption of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing in the future.
North Korea reacted harshly to the comments, with a leading official saying the U.S. would face a very grave situation if it did not end its hostile policy. In South Korea, Washington's rhetoric was met with disappointment.
The Biden administration has said it will pursue resolute deterrence while the North Korean nuclear issue is a threat to the world peace. So for Pyongyang, Washington's hostile policy seems only a pretext to strengthen itself.
North Korea has been subject to U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which Pyongyang would like to be suspended. There are also other moves the U.S. could make to get talks going.
Since there is a large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in August that North Korea sees as a hostile, an announcement suspending these drills would help create an atmosphere of dialogue.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with President Biden at the Oval Office later this month, where he's likely to press for engagement between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Sunday that Washington's policies not aimed at hostility, but solutions. The question is whether those solutions involve U.S. incentives that will bring Pyongyang to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
U.S.-led NATO forces are spending their last months in Afghanistan, and this is good news for most American soldiers. They will finally witness the end of their mission in a country historically known as the Graveyard of Empires. This is why the U.S. war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of 90,000 U.S.-led NATO troops and Afghan armed forces. However, military top brass in Kabul insists that there is zero chance of victory for the Taliban through militarism, despite the start of foreign troops withdrawal from Afghanistan on Saturday. This is because the Afghan government is now strong enough to counter terrorist groups on its own and also enjoys high popularity among locals.
The withdrawal of foreign forces has practically started. They will hand over their military bases and some of their military hardware to Afghan forces by the end of this week. We are strong enough and we can safeguard the nation on our own.
In the meantime, the Taliban have not welcomed the troop pullout by Washington, saying the U.S. had agreed to withdraw all foreign military forces from Afghanistan by the May 1st. This has paved the way for the Taliban to legitimize their acts of violence beyond May the 1st. Under such circumstances, civilians will once again turn into the main victims of violence in the war-weary country.
Foreign troops must leave our country, and the Taliban are also expected to respect people's demand, that is the silence of guns. There must be no war among ourselves after the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban need to realize this reality.
The Taliban are seeking excuses to keep saying no to peace. The postponement of the U.S. military withdrawal has now turned into a good pretext for them to wage more war and kill more defenseless civilians.
The Taliban have vowed to take any possible action because of what they call the violation of the Doha Agreement by Washington, that is the delay in the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. However, what remains to be a bitter truth is that not many players seem to be ready to truly help Afghans see a day when there is no war and insecurity in their wounded homeland. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Pakistan's federal parliament in Islamabad. The lower house of the parliament is preparing to resume a debate on whether or not to expel French ambassador over a repeated incident of blasphemy in France against Islam's last prophet Muhammad. However, days before the resumption of parliamentary debate here, the European Union Parliament has come up with what appears to be counter-resolution to pressurize Islamabad to prevent the expulsion of French envoy from Pakistan. The European Parliament has decided to review with Pakistan our trade agreement known as Generalized System of Preferential Plus or GPS Plus over what it calls a rising anti-French sentiments and mistreatment of minorities under blasphemy laws in Pakistan. Under this trade deal, Islamabad gets an estimated annual additional $1.5 billion trade benefits, which are far less than the economic losses Pakistan suffers almost every year because of mass unrest linked with Islamophobia in France. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in France has led to mass unrest across Pakistan.
The European Union is putting pressure on Pakistan, and they want them to weigh and to see whether this decision of expelling the French ambassador from Pakistan, will the government of Pakistan, will the people of Pakistan pay the price? Are they ready?
European Union's concerns go much beyond possibly expelling French ambassador.
Prime Minister Khan has crossed the Rubicon. EU policy towards countries that enable Islamic extremism must be resolute. Withdraw Pakistan's GSP Plus status now.
In an official reaction, Islamabad expressed disappointment with the European Union, pointing out that it reflects a lack of understanding in the context of blasphemy and associated religious sensitivities in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world.
None of the convicts of the blasphemy law was ever executed in Pakistan after successful governments and superior judiciary allegedly buckled under pressure to set convicts free and led them to migrate and settle in Europe. This has led to lynching of 75 under trial prisoners and suspects amid reports of misuse of blasphemy law in isolated cases since 1987 onwards. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Every year on the 1st of May, protesters fill the streets of cities around the world, marching on what's known as May Day or International Labour Day. Demonstrators usually consist of various groups supporting a wide variety of causes. Yet this year in the UK, activists joined more than 40 protests throughout the country, centred around one thing: opposition to the controversial police crime sentencing and courts bill, with the main focus of dissent coming from London.
Most notable to me were the fact that the police, under the powers of this legislation, and this is new, will be able to say that this demonstration, for example, through the noise that it's causing, is causing a nuisance. And if that nuisance is serious, they will be able to arrest people, fine them up to £10,000, and imprison them.
What will be next? That bill comes through, that's just going to be one of a whole range of new policies and things that would just silence any form of criticism.
The new legislation pending in Parliament could allow police to impose conditions on protests, including start and finish times and the imposition of noise limits. This bill would also allow the police to prematurely end a protest if it caused serious annoyance to the surrounding community, organisation and businesses, which demonstrators argue is the whole point of protests.
This bill makes it impossible to have any kind of strike, any kind of picket that has any effect.
Thousands upon thousands have turned up here to defend the right to protest, something Brits up and down the country feel is under threat.
More than 600 civil society and protest groups have called for the government to drop the legislation, and the mobilisation of protesters on the streets has already forced a planned passage through Parliament to be delayed. Yet only time will tell whether the huge protests up and down the country has successfully defeated the anti-protest bill. Ahmed Gabello, London.
Ooh.
known that Allama Amini has been regarded as a personality to whom many authorities have been attracted, both Muslim and non-Muslim. I don't say, well, I mean, both Shia and non-Shia, no, both Muslim and non-Muslim.
Allama Amini was an extraordinary scholar who never agreed on a little things. Even when you look at the book Al-Ghadir, and he has other books as well. So it shows his devotion towards Islam, how sincere he was, and how much he was very much involved in the knowledge and learning the knowledge.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. In this episode, we want to talk about Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, the great author of the book Al-Ghadir. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and another, a faculty member of the University of Qom, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
Today, we want to talk about another outstanding achievement of the late Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, and that is the foundation of Amir al-Mu'mineen Library in the city of Najaf. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, we know that we had great scholars, we can say, especially in contemporary time, which dedicated their lives to collecting the manuscripts and founding the libraries on the Islamic books and the Shia resources, and really are the source of benefit nowadays for so many other researchers and scholars, both Muslims and non-Muslims. For sure, Amir al-Mu'mineen Library beside Ayatollah Marashi Najafi's library in the city of Qom are two great outstanding libraries. But let's dedicate this discussion, I mean this episode, to Amir al-Mu'mineen Library. Why Amir al-Mu'mineen Library is regarded as one of the greatest Islamic libraries all across the world of Islam, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The point is that Allama Amini, because of his being in close contact with the leading libraries in various countries, he felt it very much necessary to found a great library on a par with major libraries he visited here and there in the world for the city of Najaf. It doesn't mean that Najaf was absolutely without any library. No, there were some small libraries in Najaf. For example, the Hosseiniyye of the people of Shushtar in Najaf had a library, a very small library.
Okay.
Or some leading scholars over there had their own private collections.
That's right.
However, the city of Najaf was in need of, was very much in need of having a good library of itself, so that when scholars from here and there would travel to Najaf, they would have a place for not only finding the desired books, but also a place as the academic rendezvous to meet each other over there. Okay, and Allama Amini's initial project regarding his library wasn't a library; it was like a research institute over there. Okay, however, because of many financial shortcomings or other problems, and mainly the problems posed by the Ba'athist regime in Iraq for Shia ulama, and especially those who were originally Iranian. Allama Amini didn't find the right facilities to develop as well as he anticipated it
to be.
Okay.
This was my next question. Most of the research time of Allama Amini was passed during the Ba'ath regime, in Iraq. And I think that was really difficult for him to, tolerate the atmosphere over there.
Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. Allama Amini passed away in Tehran. Mm-hmm. Okay. When he died in Tehran, his children wanted to take his body to Najaf, to the library, for burial.
Okay.
However, the Ba'athist regime never issued an entry visa for the body of Allama Amini to be taken to Najaf. And because of this, Allama Amini's body was taken to a hospital in Tehran, in the cold storage over there. Until the Iraqi ambassador to Tehran at that time received a permission from Baghdad that Allama Amini's body was permitted to be taken to Najaf. Okay, yes, if you want to review the, I mean, the cultural crimes of the atheist regimes, I think several, I mean, programs should be made regarding the cultural crimes of the atheist regimes.
Thank you
regarding Shia, I mean, sequels over there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani. I will get back to you regarding Amir al-Mu'mineen Library, how many books are over there and in what languages. But Said Mohsen, for now, this sunnah of, we can say, establishing library or having a research center for the ulama in that time is really beautiful. And one of the, I think, was one of the innovations of Allama Amini on that time too. I mean, for the coming generations, and we know that the following generations are benefiting from this resource nowadays in Najaf. So many of the Kansai Hausa students over there are benefiting from the manuscripts for the research projects. Talk a little bit about the sunnah, I mean, this tradition of the library thing for us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Obviously, such a thing cannot be done by a person who has not bear the hardness of collecting knowledge or going after knowledge. That's collecting
right.
books.
Okay.
It is only can be done by a person who have spent his whole life in struggling for books, in struggling for the knowledge, in order to know something, in order to find something. And this struggling, obviously, there is a pain in it, there is hardship in it. And for his next generation, he does not want this to be done. Obviously, he knows, he himself knows that how much time was wasted in traveling, for
That's
example.
Right.
Like when he was traveling from Iraq to India, for example, how many days he spent on the way.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really suffering because of this time which is wasted in the in the journey.
Okay.
And that's what he did not want it for the rest of people. For example, about Allama Marashi or the Allama Amini, they both obviously, when we look at their libraries, it shows us like how much obviously they give importance to this, number one. Number two, when we say Najaf is the city of knowledge because of Imam Ali alayhi salam, there should be a library which should be the center of all, we can say like, which has all the resources from the Islam. That if
That's
a person enters the city of knowledge, he should have a place where he can refer to the knowledge.
That's right.
So this was another idea behind him. And that's why he made that big library in the Najaf as a source of knowledge, for example, for the scholars who want to do research.
Yes.
And yes, it is very true. And we can...
Have you ever yourself visited?
No.
No.
Because I visited Iraq in Arba'in and it's too crowded.
Okay.
And obviously
yes.
it's overcrowded.
Okay. Where is it exactly located, Dr. Fakhwani? In Shahr al-Rasul?
In Shahr al-Rasul, in a small alley called Suq al-Huwaish. Very narrow but long way.
Okay.
On both sides, you find bookshops and representative of leading publishers in the whole Arab world.
Uh-huh.
Okay, when you enter that way, that lane.
I mean, that's the book market?
Yes.
That's a book market at Najaf?
Yes. Okay. When you leave Imam Ali's Qibla Shrine, it's located on your right hand.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and when you enter the lane, if I'm not mistaken, the fifth or the sixth, narrow street on the left side.
Okay.
When you enter it, the library is just in front
so
of you.
It's after Ayatollah Sistani's office.
No, Ayatollah Sistani's office is on the other hand of
Shahr
al-Rasul. When you leave Imam Ali's shrine on the Qibla gate, Ayatollah Sistani's house is on the left side, the library is on the right side.
Okay. And the tomb of Ayatollah Amini is over there too?
Yes, exactly in the same library.
Okay.
Yes.
And
so
I think
it's before the next checkpoint. There are two checkpoints.
Yes.
It's before. It's
right.
in between. So,
everyone who visits the tomb of Allama Amini can visit the library too.
Library.
And is the library open for everyone? Is it a public library? I mean,
It used to be.
The manuscripts are precious.
The manuscripts are kept in the basement.
Okay.
In a special place.
Have you ever
basement.
Visited yourself over there?
Yes.
The manuscripts?
Sorry, I should like to say that I had the opportunity of paying pilgrimage to the handwriting of Allama Amini several times.
Oh,
yes.
Handwriting of himself?
Yes, to pay pilgrimage to the handwritings of Al Lamami.
In Arabic?
Yes.
And was it beautiful, his handwriting?
Yes, yes, very beautiful.
So, and Al Ghadir was written in handwritten and then typed
yes,
into?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. And Al Ghadir received two major editions. So the first edition was published in 9 volumes. And this 11th edition, okay, is in fact, is the second edition, the second and the revised edition.
The revised edition?
Yes.
Revised by a scholar?
No, revised by Allama Amin himself.
By Allama Amin himself?
Yes.
Okay.
Because the first edition had some misprints and typos.
Oh, and all of them were handwritten?
Initially, yes.
Initial handwritten and then checked in. What about the English translation or the Farsi translation?
So far as I know, I haven't seen any English translation of Allama Amin.
Really?
Yes, I haven't seen. But so far as I know, the Iraqi Shia scholars, the late Dr. Safah Lusi, who was a great figure in translation studies, okay,